Two divers, Fergus and Philip Rophy, tragically lost their lives earlier this month during a training dive in Portrow Dive Centre in County Tipperary. Our sympathies are with their families, and scuba diving can be dangerous, but it has a lasting appeal for participants. Martin Bailey-Johnson is a lead diver with the Curragh Sub Aqua Club, and he's written about his dives on the wrecks of the World War I German Navy in Scotland's Scapa Flow. I met him in County Wicklow this week. He told me about the Curragh Club.
It's one of the oldest clubs in Dublin. It's been around since 1958. It was originally started in the Curragh Army Camp by Army officers. And I've been with them about 9 years now at this stage. One of the trips do, we do a lot of scuba diving around Dublin, and we also do trips abroad as well. So I organised a trip last year to dive on the German shipwrecks in Scapa Flow. Yeah, at the end of the First World War, the German Navy, their ships were interned, I believe around over 70 ships were taken from the different places, and they were all kept in Scapa Flow, which is a natural harbour of a large water just above the top of Scotland in the Orkney Islands.
What's it like up there? Is the water very deep? Does the inlet go in a long way?
Yeah, it's actually quite big. It's a massive expanse surrounded. It's a natural body of water formed by the islands up there. So it can be quite deep in places. Most of the wrecks that we were diving on go down to about 45 metres, a lot of the stuff we did. So anywhere between 15 metres to up to 45 metres, you can get different wrecks up there. So if you pick up any dive guide, best diving in the world, you find that the best wreck diving, or some of the best wreck diving, is in Scapa Flow.
You think there are about 75 ships there?
There were 75 ships sunk initially by the fleet. They weren't all sunk. I think about 50-something were sunk. And then a lot of them were salvaged over the years for the metal in them. So the main ones of the German ships, when you go up there now, there's four cruisers left and three large battleships up there, the main ones that you dive on. And also there's a lot of what's known as block ships. So during the First and Second World War, the British actually sunk a lot of old ships to stop submarines coming in.
But as we heard on the programme a couple of weeks ago, in the Second World War, they didn't actually manage to stop one submarine that went in and sunk.
It's the HMS Royal Oak, as far as I recall. Yeah, it was a famous U-boat commander sailed in very shortly after the Second World War started, and he managed to hit the ship with a torpedo, and then he managed to hit it again a second time, and it turned over. And when you're up diving in Scapa Flow, there was a huge loss of life on that particular ship, so there's no diving on it. I believe the Navy dive, I think it's every year, and they put an ensign, which is the Royal Navy flag, they fly it on it. So yeah, and you can see there's a buoy marking where the wreck is, and you see it when you're going in and out on dive trips there.
So you went up there last year.
To get to Scapa Flow, it's a very big journey. So to begin with, what we did was we drove up to Belfast, and there were different groups of us went over together. So we had two or three people in different cars, and then we got the evening ferry over. And then when we landed in Kenryon in Scotland, and then we drove up as far as a place called Ayr, which is about an hour north of there.
Yeah, it's a very long way from Ayr up to the Highlands, as I know.
So we stopped there and we stayed overnight. And the next day we drove, it's about another 8 hours to get to the top of Scotland. It's a very long journey. So we headed up there, and then we got a second ferry. And we got to a place that's about 2 hours that journey. And then we got over to Stromness, which is where our liveaboard boat was based. So it was next to the ferry. It was a couple hundred metres from the ferry. So that was our sort of base for the week then. So we dived 7 days in total. We managed to dive on all the cruisers, the four German cruisers, the three German battleships. We also dived on a submarine as well that was lost at the end of the First World War. It went into the harbour, and the British, they could hear it from hydro detection, and they sank it with a remote mine. So then in the 1970s, because of it was a hazard, the Royal Navy, they went down and they removed any remains of anyone on it. And then there was still live explosives on it, so they blew it up. But they got a bit over excited with the explosion. They actually blew all the windows out of their own surface ship. So we dived on that as well. There was also another Second World German ship called the F2. And that was interned there, and it had sunk. This at the end of the Second World War, and then they were salvaging the guns and thing off in a barge when there was a storm broke up, I think in the 1960s possibly, and it sank as well. So it sits beside the wreck they were salvaging, and you can dive first on the barge, and the rope connects it to the rest of the wreck, so we dived that. Some of those ships, they're in shallower water, so when you're diving, you generally do your deeper dives in the morning and shallower one in the afternoon. So we would have dived that in the afternoon. And then there's, like I said, there's block ships there, and there's also different sort of wrecks around, smaller German ships that were half salvaged, and sort of the debris or bits of them were in shallow dives. So that's the sort of stuff we were doing after the main ships, yeah.
I see from the photographs in your magazine that some of the ships seem in good condition. Their guns are still there.
Yeah, a lot of the ships still have their guns on them. That was actually my third trip to Scapa Flow, and I noticed it was 10 years between the last two trips I did, and you could see the ships were starting to decay more, where the decks were sort of made of teak. They're starting to peel away now from the superstructure.
What was visibility like?
It was pretty good. Depending on what you're diving on. So if you're on some of the ships, it could have been maybe 7-8 meters on some of the wrecks we were on. You're finding the
block... Which is fairly shallow in comparative terms.
Yeah, so that's the visibility. So that's the length that you can see underwater. From a depth point of view, we were diving on some of the smaller block ships, could have been in about, I think the shallowest one we did was in about 10 meters. And the deepest one we did was probably about 42, 43 meters.
Now, diving to a depth of 40 meters, more than 25 meters, is much more specialized.
Yeah, well, what happens is because you're diving at a deeper depth, you have a couple of choices. You're either, your bottom time is reduced, or you're diving with doing decompression diving, which means as you're coming back up, you're penalized for the extra time you spent there, and you can't come straight up. So what you need to do is spend time at certain depths. So your computer will work this out for you. And also generally before you do the dive, you work out your depths and you have a backup plan with you as well. So you can work out where you need to stop, just in case an emergency and the computer stops working.
So, for example, you're doing those deepest dives you do. How long would you have on the bottom?
That's a good question. I wouldn't know the exact numbers off the top of my head. If you're down at 45 meters or something like that, you could find that you've only 7-8 minutes if you're not doing decompression diving. But what you find is, obviously, when you do your dive, because these ships are so large, you can go down to the deepest part at the start and you can start working your way back up. And as you're coming back up, your computer adjusts and gives you more time for now.
We're going to take a look at some of your equipment.
No problem, yeah.
In your shed here. So here we've got your tank.
So that's a standard tank. They come in different sizes. That's a 12-litre tank. Now, when I'm diving in Scapa Flow, obviously to have that bit of extra air for redundancy is good. So I was diving with a larger tank. You see one on the corner, a 15-litre tank. Yeah. And a lot of people who are doing a lot of decompression wear what's known as a twin set. So they have a double tank. So you see a small pair there in the corner as well.
And these things, they're very, very heavy. Like, I mean, you're not going to be walking around with that.
No, generally. And also what you'd have is a small tank as well for redundancy on the side, just in case of a problem with your main one. So when you kit up, you're on the side of, basically, it's like a fishing trawler, converted fishing trawler. So you sit down and you're on your bench. You put all your gear on. You run through your body checks with your body. You make sure all your equipment's working. And then it's a short walk over with everything. Mm. And you step off the deck. And then you're in the water. Now, obviously, when you're in the water, you have more sort of buoyancy in the water. So there's a couple of things you need to wear, a large weight belt to help you get
even,
down.
Even with this, even and with I picked that up, it's probably, when it's full, it's probably about 15 kilograms.
Yeah, so I generally, on top of that, you can see there's a weight belt there. So there's about 10 kilos on that weight belt as well to help me get down. And then you have your this is known as a BCD.
This is like your jacket or waistcoat.
That's like your jacket as well. And basically what you can do is you can pump air into this, it's connected to the tank as well, and let air out of it. So as you're going deeper, your air is compressing. So if you want to stay buoyant, you have to put more air into it. And as you're coming up, as the air is expanding, you let the air out.
Okay, so it's for all the words, like a bit of a self-inflated life jacket. You just bring yourself up and down with it.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And you're adjusting the air in it to match the depth you're at. Yeah, because obviously you don't want to go up too quick. So you're letting air out as you're coming up.
Now, you have your breathing regulator, but then you've got all these other tubes and dials coming off it. What are they?
So basically, you have obviously you've got one regulator which you breathe through yourself, and then you have a spare regulator known as an octopus, and that is for your body in case they get in trouble and then they need to you need to share or give them air from the spare regulator. You've also got a pressure gauge, so that reads how much air is in your tank. So obviously that's good to know. So at a certain point, you know, you have to turn your dive and head back when you get to a certain point of pressure. I've also got a compass, which is handy when you're diving, just for moving around. Now, you would find on a shipwreck, because there's metal around you, it can distort the compass a little bit as well. So when you're diving in colder water, generally you would wear a dry suit, which is sealed at the neck, the wrists, and then you can put air into it. Because now that you're sealed, obviously there's a pocket of air there, and as you're going deeper, that's compressing, so it's squeezing on your body. So what you're doing is, there's a button on the front, and you pump air into it, and that equalises the air inside, so you're not getting squeezed. And then you have a vent on that, so as you're coming up, it will vent and let the air back out.
Now, you have also a couple of computers that you wear on your wrist.
Yeah, so basically I have a couple of things that I wear. I have a dive computer, and what that will do for me is that will work out the depth I'm at and also how long I can stay at that depth as well, and how long I'm there. And it will also tell me then as I'm coming back up, it will compensate the time and it will adjust, give me more time the shallower I am.
So it's reading your depth at the same time?
Yeah, it's reading the depth as well, yeah. It also notes, as I was saying, my time underwater. But what it also does, it switches to two gases. Okay, so as I was saying about decompression earlier on, if you're using a different mixture of gas with more oxygen in at shallower level, it means you can off-gas. So you're getting rid of the nitrogen in your system that you've got from the dive.
Okay, when you speak about a mixture of gases, what gases are you putting in?
So mainly, I have my tank, but it's basically air for most of the dives. And then when, so that's air is made up of 21% oxygen and 79% nitrogen. And then when you're at a shallower depth, you can breathe more oxygen. If you breathe too much oxygen at a certain depth, it can be toxic. Mm-hmm. So you bring a smaller bottle with more oxygen in it. And then as you're coming back up, you can switch to that bottle when you're doing decompression diving. And that will mean you've less time to decompress. So my computer allows me to switch to a different mixture, as such is what it's known, and then that will work out how much time I now have to stay at a certain depth based on the new mixture I've put into it.
It sounds incredibly complicated. How many years have you spent training for all of this?
I've been diving for about 14 or 15 years, I think, at this stage. To do this, to sort of use the different gases, there's different levels you can go to. There's nitrox you're doing, and there's an advanced nitrox, which is the level I'm at. And you can go on again to do, there's many people in our club who are on the trip who do extended range, who use twin sets, and they use different mixtures again. So they were doing different types of diving as well.
Is it a very expensive sport?
There's initial outlay to buy equipment, but then equipment can last a good few years. Tanks, they have to be serviced every 2.5 years. But then a tank will last a long time after that, and regulators need to be serviced once a year. So it's important if you take care of the equipment, it can last a long time. That particular BCD is known as
the jacket.
Yeah, it's one AP Valves Commando jacket, and I've seen people have them maybe 20 years as long as they're getting serviced. So a dry suit as well is an expensive piece of equipment, but it will last a long time. Yeah.
If you join the club, you're spreading the expenses for a lot of other stuff.
So what you do is with my club now, when you join my club, obviously we're a large club. We have we've two boats and we've our own clubhouse. So what we do is we pay a fee every year, but then our club dives 3 or 4 times a week in Dublin, and all that diving is then included in your fee. So it can work out quite cheap if you're diving regularly, yeah.
What would your initial outlay be if you wanted to start off?
If you were buying all your equipment from scratch, you'd probably spend maybe around €2,000. Now, if you join the likes of our club, what we do is we will supply the gear up until for training at a certain point. And then when you get to a certain point, we expect people to sort of start buying gear. So when you start training the pool for a few months, we would supply the gear. And then after sort of when they get to the open water, we expect people to sort of have decided then that stage if they sort of like it and to sort of be buying their own kit.
If anybody wants to inquire about your club, where will we find you?
You can find us on the web. It's www.csac.ie. So it's the Curragh Tobacco Club. If you Google that as well, you should find many things on it as well, yeah.
What would your favourite dives in Ireland be? If you're going to recommend a couple to people, what would you recommend?
The diving in Donegal is fabulous. Over in the West is very good as well. Just some good diving in Dublin. In Dublin Bay, there's a couple of good wrecks out there as well. So I like that as well. So there's plenty of places to go.
Martin Bailey-Johnson from the Curragh Sub-Aqua Club. Now, if you're thinking of buying an island around the coast, you might have been disappointed to have missed out on Horse Island. It sold during the week, having been on the market for the last 2 years. It fetched $5.5 million and was sold to a European bidder whose identity has not been disclosed. But apparently, the underbidder was a Chinese woman. But there might be a silver lining for her. A nearby island in Cork's Roaring Water Bay has come up for sale in the last couple of days with a price tag of, wait for it, $1 million. Castle Island is being sold by Cork auctioneer Dominic Daly. He told me about it.
Well, Castle Island is one of the larger islands in Roaring Water Bay. It extends to 123 acres. There are quite extensive ruins on it, up to 15 families lived there in the last century, I understand. And nowadays, it's uninhabited and is used for farming purposes.
Now,
it's quite attractive. There's a good pier, so you can land there at most stages of the weather.
What state is the pier in? It's not too far from Bantry, for example.
Well, the pier is almost equidistant between Skull Harbour or Rossbryn Cove. And the pier is in remarkably good condition for its type and age.
Do you know when the island was inhabited and who did all the buildings? There's a castle on it, for example.
That the McCarthy family were in the business of selling water from the island in the old days, which is an unusual thing to be selling. Yeah.
Now, is there a market for an island like this?
There's always a market for an island. Over the years, I've sold quite a few islands. People come out of the cracks, show interest in islands, and hopefully comes to a conclusion.
Now, for example, on Castle Island, would it be possible to put a few buildings there? Would you get planning permission?
Well, you'd have to apply for planning, but I think you're starting with an advantage that historically there were quite a number of houses on the island, and there are significant ruins there still.
There are beaches there, from what I can see?
There are. There are nice beaches. Quite a lot. It's sheltered, as far as I know.
Now, a nearby island, Horse Island, which is off Skull as well, it just sold just this week, I understand.
Yes. I was on Horse Island a number of years ago. In fact, I sold it a number of years ago.
Okay.
As far as I understand now, there's a principal house on it, and there's either three or four other good houses on the island as well. A lot of money has been spent on Horse.
And a lot of money was paid for it as well, because it went for over 5 million euros.
That's what I've read in the paper. That's right, yes.
How much are you looking for Castle Island?
We're asking for offers in excess of 1 million.
Okay, and if you take it that Horse Island went for sale for over five, it's a bit of a knockdown price, or is it?
Well, Castle Island is an opportunity for someone. I think there'll be a number of people interested in it. Already we've had a number of people booked to go out to see the island. So the take-up has been quite quick, although it's only been on the market for over a week.
Is there a worldwide interest in things like this, or is it Irish or European or what?
There's worldwide. I've sold islands in Ireland to Americans, to Europeans, to Middle Eastern people. And I've also had an interest during the lockdown from people from Russia.
And will they actually get to use them? You know, will they come for an Irish summer and then decide it's not for them?
Well, one of the islands I sold in the recent past to a man from the Middle East, he spent quite a lot on the island, but he didn't really come there himself. He just had his friends there.
There's a particular question about the beaches on the island. I know, for example, Horse Island, that people go out from Skull during the summer and from Baltimore and places on their own boats and use the beaches there. They don't go inland, but there's no such thing as a private beach in Ireland.
No. As far as I understand the law, up to high water mark is public.
Okay, so I can just drive my boat onto the beach, spend my afternoon there and go away again. You can't stop me, even if you own the whole island.
You can enjoy yourself below the high water mark.
Yeah, and I think most people who own the islands don't object to that kind of usage, do they?
Yeah, they have an understanding of it.
What other islands are for sale around Ireland at the moment, do you know?
In Dunmanus Bay, I have a small island called Mannion's Island. There's quite a lot of interest in that at present. And on the Shannon Estuary, I have another island called Shore Island, near Kildaisert.
How many islands have you sold?
Maybe 10.
Never thought of buying one yourself, no?
Not yet.
How would we find out about, where will we see the details of Castle Island?
Well, there's quite a lot on my website, DominicJDaly.com, and I'm selling the island jointly with Knight Frank, so there's quite a lot on their website as well. That'll bring all the international appeal. So, fingers crossed.
Well, islands for sale are merely a dream for just about most of us. but the canals and inland waterways of Ireland are within reach of everyone. We have a huge network of inland waterways for boating, for fishing, or just walking or cycling along. Our regular contributor, Hugh Orme, tells us now about our canals.
One of the great legacies of Ireland's inland waterway system is the extensive range of canals, whose construction started in the late 18th century. Fortunately, many of them still survive and can still be used. The Inland Waterways Association of Ireland, which operates in the whole of Ireland, was set up nearly 70 years ago in 1954. In the years and decades from then until now, it has performed sterling service in its unremitting campaign to conserve and protect Ireland's inland waterways and keep them in navigable condition. It has around 20 branches north and south, which means that it's very active wherever there are inland waterways. Today, there are seven canals that are still navigable: the Ardna Crusher Canal, the Grand Canal, the Jamestown Canal, the Lecaro Canal, the Royal Canal, the Shannon Erne Waterway, and the Tralee Ship Canal. Of all the canals in Ireland, the best known is the Grand Canal. Its construction began in 1756, connecting Dublin with the River Shannon. Its construction was such an elongated task that it took the best part of 50 years for the work to be completed. It stretched for just over 130 kilometres, with a grand total of 43 locks. Until 1950, this canal remained in the ownership of the Grand Canal Company. Its ownership was then transferred to CIE, then again to the Office of Public Works. Under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, a new inland waterways body was set up for the whole of Ireland, Waterways Ireland, which came into operation in 1999. It took over responsibility for most of the navigable inland waterways, including the Grand Canal. The development of the Grand Canal created many disputes, so in 1790, construction began of a rival canal, the Royal Canal. It wasn't completed until 1817, but the first steamer to use the canal to sail from Dublin to Limerick didn't set sail until 1826. The Grand Canal hasn't always been watertight. On various occasions over the years, there were breaches on both the main canal and its branches, the most recent being in 1989, when about 30 kilometres of the canal drained into the surrounding countryside. And it's 1960 since the last working barge used the Grand Canal. The other big canal in the Dublin area is the Royal Canal, which runs as far as Longford. It's 145 kilometres in length. Completed in 1817, it was well used throughout the 19th century and then well into the 20th century. It eventually fell into disuse, but has now been restored for navigation and was formally reopened in 2010. And among the many inland navigations that come under the remit of Waterways Ireland, the Royal Canal is one of them. The days when Ireland's canals were heavily dependent on commercial traffic are long gone. The Grand Canal, for instance, serviced the Guinness Brewery at Grand Canal Harbour, and the kegs of Guinness were once a familiar sight as the canal boats traversed Ireland. Other canals have been put to other uses, such as the canal at Ballinasloe, County Galway, long since abandoned and now used as an industrial railway operated by Bordnemona. While Ireland's extensive network of inland canals was built originally for commercial barge-borne traffic, these days, while there may be little remaining commercial or industrial use for them, they are still flourishing as a leisure and tourism amenity.
Hugh Orme.